Howdy, regulars. This is Regular Dispatch 53. It's July 13th, 2020. On a hot night in 1992, on my first deployment as a Pentagon reporter, I went on patrol in Mogadishu, Somalia, with a squad of Marines led by a 22-year-old corporal. Red and green tracer bullets cut arcs across the dark sky. It was a confusing and difficult time. Yet the corporal led the patrol with a confidence that was contagious. Ever since that night, I'd wanted to see how the Marine Corps turns teenage Americans into self-confident leaders. At a time when the nation seems distrustful of its teenage males, when young black men especially, and wrongly, are figures of fear for many, the military is different. It isn't just that it has done a better job than the larger society in dealing with drug abuse and racial tension, even though that is true. It also seems to be doing a better job of teaching teenagers the right way to live than does, say, the average American high school. And it thrives while drawing most of its personnel from the bottom half of our society, the half that isn't surfing the information superhighway. I wanted to see how the Marines could turn an undereducated, cynical teenager into that young soldier who, on his second night in Africa, could lead a file of men through the dark and dangerous city. How could a kid we would not trust to run the copier by himself back in my office in Washington become the squad leader addressing questions that could alter national policy? Do I shoot at this threatening mob in a third world city? Do I fire when a local police officer points his weapon in my direction? If I am performing a limited peacekeeping mission, do I stop a rape when it occurs 50 yards in front of my position? To find out how the Marines give young Americans the values and self-confidence to make those decisions, I decided to go to Marine boot camp. I went not as a recruit, but as an observer. I come from the post-draft generation. I majored in English literature at Yale. And, like everybody with whom I grew up and went to school, I have no military experience. Yet I learned things at Paris Island that fascinated me and should interest anyone who cares about where our youth are going. In a society that seems to have trouble transmitting healthy values, the Marines stand out as a successful institution that unabashedly teaches those values to the Beavises and Buttheads of America. I met Platoon 3086 on a foggy late winter night in 1995 when its bus arrived on Paris Island, South Carolina. I followed the recruits intermittently for their 11 weeks on the island, then during their first 2 years in the Marine Corps. The recruits arrived steeped in the popular American culture of consumerism and individualism. To a surprising degree, before joining the Corps, they had been living part-time lives, working part-time, going to community college part-time and getting lousy grades, and staying dazed on drugs and alcohol part-time. When they arrived on Paris Island, all that was taken away from them. They were stripped of the usual distractions, from television and music to cars and candy. They even lost the right to refer to themselves as I or me. When one confused recruit did so during the first week of boot camp, Sergeant Darren Carey, the platoon's heavy hat disciplinarian, stomped his foot on the cement floor and shouted, "You got on the wrong bus, because there ain't no I, me, mys, or eyes here." On Paris Island, for every waking moment during the next 11 weeks, they were immersed in a new, very different world. For the first time in their lives, many encountered absolute standards. Tell the truth. Don't give up. Don't whine. Look out for the group before you look out for yourself. Always do your best, even if you are just mopping the floor. You owe it to yourself and your comrades to strive to be the best mopper at this moment in the Corps. Judge others by their actions, not their words or their race. The drill instructors weren't interested in excuses. Every day, they transmitted the lesson taught centuries ago by the ancient Greek philosophers. Don't pursue happiness, pursue excellence. Make a habit of that, and you can have a fulfilling life. These aren't complex ideas, but to persuade a cynical teenager to follow them, they must be painstakingly pursued every day. Lived as well as preached. I've seen few people work as hard as did Platoon 3086's drill instructors in the first few weeks they led the platoon. Sergeant Carey, an intense young reconnaissance specialist from Long Island, routinely put in 17 hours a day, 6.5 days a week. His ability to drive himself at full speed all day long awed and inspired his charges. Recruit Paul Barassa said of his drill instructor, "When you're gone 16 hours and you're wiped out and you see him murdering, you say to yourself, I've got to tap into whatever he has." Sergeant Carey clearly wasn't doing it for the money. He was paid $1,775 a month, a figure that worked out to about the minimum wage. Of course, the wages were nearly irrelevant. The recruits learned that money isn't the measure of a man, that a person's real wealth is in his character. One of the funniest moments I saw in boot camp came when Sergeant Carey was lecturing the platoon on the importance of knowledge. "Knowledge is what?" he bellowed. "Power, sir," responded the platoon. "Power is what?" he then asked. That puzzled the platoon, faces scrunched up in thought. Eventually, one recruit hazarded a guess. "Money?" Sergeant Carey was dumbfounded to find such a civilian attitude persisting in his platoon. "No," he shouted. "Power is victory." Then in a whispered aside, he added, "I swear I'm dealing with aliens." The drill instructors didn't try to make their recruits happy. They tried to push the members of the platoon harder than they'd ever been pushed, to make them go beyond their own self-imposed limits. Nearly all the members of the platoon cried at one time or another. Yet by the end of the 11 weeks, almost all had been transformed by the experience and were more fulfilled than they had ever been. They had subordinated their needs to those of the group, yet almost all emerged with a stronger sense of self. They unembarrassedly used words like integrity. "I learned more than I expected." One of my favorite moments came when Sergeant Carey ordered a white supremacist from Alabama to share a tent in the woods with a black gang member from Washington, D.C. The drill instructor's message to the recruits was clear. If you two are going to be in the Marine Corps, you're going to have to learn to live with each other. Recruits Jonathan Prisch and Ernest Winston Jr. became friends during that bivouac. "We stuck up for each other after that," Prisch said. The recruits generally seemed to find race relations less of an issue at boot camp than in the neighborhoods they'd left behind. "If America were more like the Marines," argued Luis Polanco Medina, a recruit from New Jersey, "there would be less crime, less racial tension among the people, because Marine Corps discipline is also about brotherhood." Two other things surprised me. I didn't hear a lot of profanity. Once notoriously foul-mouthed, today's drill instructors generally are forbidden to use obscenities. Also, I saw very little brutality. "I expected it to be tougher," said recruit Edward Linsky in a typical comment as he sat on his footlocker. Platoon 3086 graduated into the Marine Corps in May 1995 and became part of a family that includes 174,000 active duty members and 2.1 million veterans. There really is no such thing as an ex-Marine. Over the last 2 years, members of the platoon have experienced some disappointments, but as Paul Barassa concluded a year after graduating from boot camp, it pretty much is a band of brothers. What I think the Marine Corps represents is counterculture, but the Marines are rebels with a cause. With their emphasis on honor, courage, and commitment, they offer a powerful alternative to the loneliness and distrust that seems so widespread, especially among our youth. Any American, young or old, pro or anti-military, can learn something from today's Corps. That goes for the corporation as well as the individual. Just listen to Major Stephen Davis describe his approach to leadership. "Concentrate on doing a single task as simply as you can. Execute it flawlessly. Take care of your people and go home." Those steps offer an efficient way to run any organization. I took away a lot from boot camp myself. I don't talk to my own kids like a drill instructor, and neither do thoughtful drill instructors. But I was struck by the importance of the example the DIs provided. Kids want values, but they are rightly suspicious of talk without action. So while you need to talk to kids about values, your words will be meaningless unless you live them as well. Also, of all the things that can motivate people, the pursuit of excellence is one of the most effective and one of the least used in our society. None of this is a revelation. Lots of families live by these standards, but few of our public institutions seem to. You'd see the drill instructors teach kids who barely made it through high school, and they weren't stupid, that they could do things. You'd see the drill instructors teach kids who barely made it through high school that they weren't stupid, that they could do things if they had the right can-do attitude, summarized Charles Lees of Platoon 3086. It was all the things you should learn growing up, but for some reason, society de-emphasizes. The white supremacist and the black gang member who were thrown together in boot camp both went on to happy careers in the Corps. Ernest Winston Jr., the D.C. gangbanger, became a specialist in the recovery of aircraft making emergency landings and was posted to Japan. "It's beautiful," he told me. "Not a lot of people on my block go to places like these." His friend, Jonathan Prish, the Alabaman, became a guard near the American Embassy in London. Prish had his racist tattoos covered. "I've left all that behind," he said. "You go out and see the world, and you see there are cool people in all colors." This is obviously dated phrases like information superhighway, kind of giveaways, and he's referring to, starting with these recruits in 1995. I believe this came out in Parade magazine, and I think I read it sitting, I was back home visiting my folks, I think. Paper was out, and I read the article. It's by Thomas Ricks, who's gone on to do a lot of reporting on the Iraq War and all kinds of stuff. Big, author, a lot of books, a lot of writing. I guess I remembered the article too. It's the simple truths like focusing on excellence more, and then happiness is a byproduct. Happiness is not the target. Happiness comes along for the ride. I like that. This is, from 1995, I don't actually know. I'm a suburb kid, civilian. I have not ever been in the military. My friends I grew up with have been in it and are still, but I can't, from firsthand experience, relate to the authenticity or how these trends have played out over a long period of time. Nonetheless, I like the message and it. I've been listening to the audiobook by David Goggins. I mentioned him in the past. He has quite a story. The book is called Can't Hurt Me. I highly recommend it. He's a sort of fierce individual and fierce proponent of breaking out of one's ruts and comfort zones. He'll run a lot of ultra stuff. He's ex-Navy SEAL. And has subjected himself to a lot of pain and suffering on purpose, and has formulated his realizations in cool ways. And hearing him discuss some of the Navy SEAL stuff, it kind of reminded me of this article. And modern search engines are kind of crazy. You can type in old phrases and stuff. I didn't remember who wrote it or when it came out, but I was able to find a copy of it here on the internet. It's pretty amazing. Another thing about it, of course, it stands in this kind of approach, this kind of culture stands in stark contrast to the Seven Lessons School Teacher by John Taylor Gatto, which I will link to again in the show notes. And if you go to regular.fm, there's little tags on episodes. And so if you want to find the trail when I've talked about education or Gatto or whatever, I'm using those a little bit, hoping they'll provide some use over time. But the 7-Eleven lesson school teacher is alleging that modern compulsory government so-called public schooling is really teaching emotional dependence, incoherence, confusion, these kinds of lessons in the way that it's designed, in the way that it operates. And something like the Marine Corps coming along and in Rick's words, being counterculture. That's kind of a funny turn of phrase because you don't think of Marines, the United States Marine Corps, as being counterculture, though the personal testimony of somebody like Jocko Willink, he grew up, I believe, in New England somewhere. I don't remember exactly. as a rebel, and he wanted to, as a sign of rebellion, he joined the Marine, he joined the Navy SEALs. That was his rebellion. So it's funny to connect those two. I've mentioned before the Acton Academy, and I'll probably read this week from Laura Sandifer's book, which is called Courage to Grow. She shares the story of her and her husband founding the school and their experience of it. One of my favorite parts of the book is at the end. It's appendices, these artifacts, these elements that support each Acton Academy campus. And there are things like a contract that the kids write, that the kids create themselves. It's a contract that binds them to each other. It's what they're agreeing to do. They update them every year. They create big posters of these, and everyone signs it, and they're in their environment. All elementary school age kids are grouped together, between 30 and 40 of them. All junior high age kids are grouped together. All high school age kids are grouped together. They have these contracts. They have this way of doing things. They peer review each other on a rolling basis. And what they really do is create their own internal culture with their own internal standards. And they aim for excellence. And it does provide, I can't help but associate the two, this idea of the Marine Corps discipline and internal cohesion, what it means, lessons all of us can draw from it, and how it's very similar to what the Acton Academy is trying to create, in contrast to what they see as failings in the prevailing model. The nice thing, too, about aiming for excellence and understanding what the standard is you're going to fail a lot. You're not going to get it right a lot. And that kind of feedback loop is critically important. And so beware anytime you or your household or, let's say, a national economy is setting itself up where it is ignoring failures within its midst and delaying the reckoning of handling those failures. It's not a very appropriate strategy. It doesn't help in the long run. That's all for today. I'm recording this early in the morning, but not early enough. I aim to get there reading these folks, and you know, I definitely want to. I got up early today, about 5. I forgot to set an alarm, still woke up. And I didn't set an alarm over the weekend, and I got up at 5 both days, between 5 and 5:15. That's a good sign. I'm recalibrating my just basic schedule, natural rhythm, whatever. I do want to get up, work out, run, record this thing, and y'all find it there by 7 o'clock in the morning. That would be ideal. That's what I aim for. Talk to you soon. Thanks.